Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. Well, I'm delighted today to be joined by Nuala Suchet, who's written the most wonderful and moving book called The Longest Farewell, James, Dementia and Me. And it's a very sad book. It does have some joyous moments in it, Nuala, too. And I'm pleased to say it has a happy ending, but it's very sad along the way. Would you like to tell me the story about how you first met James, your first husband?
Yes, I met James in Golden Square for an interview on a series that he was going to direct in Kenya. And as a result of that interview, I was commissioned to be the art director, and I flew out to Kenya, and I didn't really know James. He was just there, you know, kind of in the background. But once I got to Kenya, of course, I worked with him for nearly 3 weeks on location, and I really did fall in love with him. He was so talented, and it was such a lovely experience. I had an early, very early young marriage that didn't work out, and I'd been on my own for some time, and in fact, James had a similar experience to me. He had also married a medic and had been on his own for a long time. So it was like the stars aligned us, and we had something in common, and we decided to meet up when the location, when the filming was over. We returned to England to finish off the work in London, and he invited me to dinner, and within a year we married. And we had an incredible relationship. I'd had a very unhappy childhood at boarding school. Never knew what it was like to be really loved and cherished. And with James, I had that in, you know, a bucket full. And it was the first time I think I really knew what love was. And I was like the crap plate, and he put me back together again. And I really felt my life soar. I was doing artwork and doing really well. After I married him, you know, I did really, really well. It just was lovely. It was a very happy, happy time. We traveled all over the world. We had a place in America, and our life was just wonderful. He was writing scripts and planning to go into film, having always been on a documentary director. He decided that television was changing and he would write his own screenplays and make films. And that's where we were when the alien dementia entered our lives. And we'd been together then about 11 years, and this all started to change when strange behavior was happening. And I didn't know what it was. I just thought it was overwork. James was writing scripts, he was traveling, and things just started to not connect. He was just forgetting things. And we went to a meeting with some producers to do a film. He'd just written the script, and they loved the script and wanted to make it be his producer and, you know, get the funding and so on. And we arrived at the meeting, and they asked him, "Oh, James, we love this. How do you see it working? Who do you want to play? So and so, so and so." And, you know, silence. You know, James didn't react. He didn't respond. And I tried to fill in the gaps because I knew the script off by heart, as you do when you live with someone. And the meeting went on for half an hour, and in the end, the producer just said, "Look, let's organize another date," and we left. And when we got outside, he took me aside, the producer, and said, "What's going on?" I said, "I have no idea." I said, this was all arranged. It was all, we went through what he was going to say and how he was going to describe and who he wanted to play the roles, et cetera, et cetera. And then I came home, back to our home, and other strange things happened. We traveled to the States where we had a home, and we were out one day sailing on a boat, and he jumped off and left me on board didn't come back. It was very deep water, and I would never, ever go into deep water. Normally, he would carry me piggyback to the shore, and it didn't happen. And lots of other strange things were happening. I would go away for a few days. I would come back. I'd find he'd cooked breakfast, dinner, tea, and everything was left as it was. So no clearing up, nothing. And then the family started to notice things. You know, they said, you know, James is not behaving correctly, or, you know, and I still didn't believe it. I just thought he's tired, you know. And then he complained of a pain down his legs, and I took him to 3 doctors, and none of them could find anything wrong. And the last one, who was a relation of Miles, said, look, he's writing all the time, he's tied to that office, he needs to get out and direct again, and he'll be fine. It's all, you know, maybe he's got a bit of depression. Anyway, we then went down to the west of Ireland to stay with a doctor friend, an old doctor friend of ours, who lived in the States and was over on holiday in her holiday home. And she observed James over 2 days, and she would ask him about his life, his films, which films did he love or whatever. And he wasn't answering. He wasn't responding in the enthusiastic way he would, like he loved. He had so many favorite directors. He would talk for hours about them and how much he loved their work. And, you know, suddenly silence. He knocked over a glass of wine. And the next morning, she said to me, I think James has a cognitive problem. There's something not right. His brain is not connected. I advise you to see a consultant. So I phoned up the various people I knew who organized for me to see a Harley Street consultant. And we saw him, and he questioned James about 20 minutes probably, and diagnosed Alzheimer's, but said, I'm not sure, but I think it's Alzheimer's. I think you should get a proper scan and so on. And then we went to the Edinburgh in Cambridge, where they spent a day giving him tests on, they did a scan, questions. And the final meeting with the consultant was that James has Pick's disease. And I said, what's Pick's disease? He said, it's temporal frontal lobe dementia. And I think he's had it for some time. And that was the shock. And he said, I'm sorry to tell you, there is no cure. We do have a drug called Aricept, but James is too far gone to give him Aricept. It wouldn't help. And I just broke down. I said, you know, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm so sorry, but dementia is a cruel disease, and there isn't anything we can do. And I then said, you know, what's the lifespan? He said, well, 1 year to 10 years. He said, I really can't even tell you that. He said, it's just one day at a time. And I just couldn't. I kept repeating, you know, are you sure? And he said, yes, I've got all the scans. And finally, he led me out into a dark gray corridor with no roadmap, no idea how I was going to navigate my way through this illness that I'd never heard of. No one in my family had dementia. I always thought it was an old person's disease that, you know, very elderly people, you know, got it. But James was in his 50s. I mean, how is that possible? So I returned home, and I think I cried, I think, for most of that week. I could not accept what, and he was oblivious. He was not aware of it, not at all. And every time he saw me crying, he would say things like, you know, you'll be okay. You'll be okay. And he would put his arms around me, and he still could speak to me. He could speak to me relatively barely, but I started to notice words were failing. And so after about a week, I decided, right, I'm going to fight this bastard disease. Excuse my language. But I was angry. I was so angry that was it. There were no drugs, no cure, and I had to fight. I could either lie down and cry for the rest of the time I had with him, or get up and fight. And I decided to fight. And I decided to juggle my career, which I did for a couple of years, but that in the end had to go because I couldn't manage James as he went further into the dementia on my career. It was a very demanding career. I became a designer, and clients would want you yesterday. So, and I was the main bread, you know, winner of that as well. And so I decided to, he loved opera. I decided to take him to all the opera houses in Europe. We traveled back to the States. He loved Paris. I went to Paris with him several times. I bought a painting he loved at an auction that we saw passing by an auction house. And I would take him to lovely places to eat or to remind him of lovely food that he liked. And that was my life for 5 years. And as the dementia crept more and more into our lives, by year 4 or 5, it was overwhelming. He spoke less. He became more incontinent. He lost his inhibitions. He would get up from the table in the middle of a meal. When I took him to Glyndebourne, to the last opera I took him to, we decided to eat in the dining room, which was a huge mistake. And when the food came, he would shrug back onto the floor. And you can imagine the very toffee-nosed English people looking on, thinking, what is going on? Is he drunk? You know, and I couldn't stand up from the table and say, no, he's got dementia. I just embarrassingly just got up from the table and took James away and left the room. And nobody came out to say, are you all right? Are you okay? So I was so embarrassed for him more than myself. I didn't really care about them. I just thought, if only you knew what this man had done and how clever he was, and this is where he is now. And finally, you know, it became impossible to shower him. He was 6 foot tall. Getting him into a shower was a battle. Getting him to change his incontinent clothes was a battle. And it just overwhelmed me. And he has a wonderful, wonderful sister that I'm so close to, who was working for Macmillan in Edinburgh. And she came over and she said to me, you've got to put James into care. You cannot manage him anymore. You've lost weight. You're looking dreadful. You're not sleeping. And I think it's kinder for him. He will get 24-hour care. You're not able to do it on your own. And that's when, with her, I decided we would put James into care. And we trolled around all these care homes, and one seemed to be worse than the other. And then Maureen found this lovely one in Chorleywood in Hertfordshire, and that's where he ended up. And they allowed me to put in pieces of furniture that he loved and painting he loved. And I blew up his life in huge, you know, photographs of his life all around the room, how we met, when we met, and his life in television as a cameraman and as a director all around his room, and his beloved Mozart. He was actually writing the life of Mozart in 6 episodes before he went into dementia, which was incredible. And he had got as far as Sony and Arts and Entertainment in America, coming in as co-producers. And he'd got that far, and then that was left aside, obviously. But he loved the music, and I had all his CDs all in the room, and that's where I ended up taking him.
What was it like when you had to leave him for the first time in that home?
It was horrendous. It was. We were living in Ireland at the time, and I drove from Ireland to Holyhead and then drove all the way down towards Chorleywood in Hertfordshire. And he could read the signs of London when we got near London. And he adored London, of course, because he was a London boy, really. So he was born in Northern Ireland. He'd spent all his life in London. And he was so excited, and he said, London, London, and he kept jumping up. And then, of course, we arrived at this care home in silence. He didn't say a word. And we came in, and the staff greeted me very kindly, and we took him up to the room. And I settled him in, and he looked around, and he didn't really know what was happening. And again, no words came out, and he was completely silent, which was really strange. Because he had this language that I understood. It would all be mixed up, but I would always get the gist of it. And, you know, it was usually, what the hell am I doing? Or, you know, where am I going? Or, you know, and I could understand it quite well. But suddenly he's in this room with all things that he probably recognized a little bit at that stage. And I put on the Mozart, the Marriage of Figaro, which he loved. And the care home manager had warned me beforehand and said, when you take him in, just arrange everything as you want, and then just walk away. Don't say goodbye. And I go, how can I not say goodbye? Anyway, I came out of the room and sobbing all the way down the corridor. And she greeted me, and I left within half an hour and got into the car, and I drove all the way up to Holyhead, sobbing the whole way. Got to the harbour, and the boat was delayed till 2 a.m. in the morning, and I thought, yes, you deserve this because you put James in a home. And I punished myself by saying, yes, you deserve this. And I was awake till the boat arrived in at 2 a.m., got on the boat, couldn't sleep, cried, got off the boat and arrived home. And my life went into this turmoil. And she advised me not to come for 2 weeks. And I just slipped into this horrendous depression of, how am I going to live without James? How am I going to have a life without him? No more did we share a bed. No more did we share anything. And the reality of it was just horrendous. And I had nothing. There was no one that I could ring to say, where do I go next? How do I manage this? It was just friends, family. But even they, in the end, after this, you know, the dementia was ongoing. There was, I couldn't give them a date. I couldn't say it's a year. It's 2 years. It was forever.
And nobody could see it.
It's invisible. He looked perfectly handsome. He was always incredibly handsome. And he never seemed to age, you know. He always looked beautiful, if you like. He had that lovely... He didn't realize how gorgeous he was, actually, and that made him even more attractive, you know. So all I could do was ring the care home every day, I would ring every single day, and they would say, look, please don't ring again. We'll tell you if there's anything changed, you know. And I'd ring up again and cry, and it would be some unknown carer that I hadn't met, and she didn't, you know, I was just a mess, an utter mess. And then I went to a cousin of mine, who's a doctor, and he gave me some antidepressants. He said, look, just take these for a few weeks. It'll help you just get through. And I decided it was too much, Dillis. I became a total coward. I thought, I can't navigate my way without James. I can't. And I decided to save these tablets up, and I would take the whole bottle one night with a favorite bottle of wine. That's how I actually got to that level. I'm not the sort of person, you know, coming from a large, eldest of nine family, boarding school, you know, I don't actually fall down very easily. I'm quite a tough little soul. As a survivor, I've always been a survivor. And suddenly I was like, oh, I just could not see a way out. And finally, 2 weeks went by and I was allowed to go and see him. And of course, I rushed up the corridor into the room and there he was. And he would reach out a little bit to me, but not much. And as the days and weeks went by, he became more and more remote, and dementia really had him completely. He was really in their power, and I couldn't reach him at all. And even when I would put on his music, he really wasn't hearing it, but he would leave the room, walk down the corridor as if I didn't exist. And that was dementia. And the awful thing was the heartbreak just didn't go. You know, I was managing it at this stage. I decided not to take any antidepressants because they were clouding the pain, if you like. And I thought, no, I'm going to go through this and feel it every step of the way and share this journey with James as much as I can. And that's what I did. But I'd often go in and find him unwashed or unshaven because he wouldn't allow him then to touch him that particular day. And that would upset me, you know, to see him, you know. And then I would take him to the bathroom and with the help of the carer, and we'd shower him and do all that. And I would be happy with that little result of the fact that I would cut his hair and do his nails and put the music on and sit on the bed and just chat. And he would just look beyond me sometimes, but at least I was there with him. I could share that bit of life with him. And then I would take him to the dining room. And of course, the care home really isn't geared for ex-directors, if you like. There are not many ex-directors in care homes. And, you know, people were playing bingo and listening to music. And it wasn't his music. It wasn't his life. And all he did have was his music. So I played his operas over and over again. He loved opera. He adored opera. So I would just put on the CD when I went into the room. And that, in a way, I used to pray would reach him somewhere. And I would tilt him downstairs, you know, for a coffee and that, but no conversation. And then I started to befriend his neighbors. One was an old retired admiral from the Navy, and he would look out from his window onto a kind of a semi car park and say, oh, it's a bit choppy today, not realizing it was a car park. They were the funny ones. And I got to know his neighbor on the other side, who was Bonnie. And she would stroll into his room very casually and sit on the bed. She would help herself to his chocolates, look around at the pictures and walk out again. And one day she was terribly cold. I gave her my pashmina. And I mean, I never saw it again because things were always taken and, you know, stolen in the care home by other patients. And I would take her downstairs. She loved hot chocolate, the carers told me. And I would take her downstairs for a hot chocolate with James. And I'd have one on either side of me because we were down in the normal part of the care home where there were just elderly patients. And the dementia care was upstairs, but that was locked. So they could only come down accompanied. So I'd have one on each side, neither talking to the other. And I would sit there for like an hour while they had their chocolate or whatever they were having. And then I would come back up again. And I really got to know her quite well. She loved Frank Sinatra. So I would put on her little CD of Frank Sinatra, and she loved ABBA. And sometimes when the carers would try to bath her, she wouldn't allow them to bath her, but she'd allow me to take her down the corridor and give her a bath and wash her hair. And she wouldn't allow me to dry it ever because she didn't like the sound of the hair dryer. But in a way, it was weird. And I knew her little story that she'd worked as a PA. She was American. She was married with two boys. So in a way, they were all little comforts to me in a strange kind of way. And I needed to go in there as often as I could because that was the way I could hold on to James. And of course, by and by, my life had stopped. I'd stopped at this stage working. I wasn't dealing with clients anymore. I couldn't face clients. I couldn't go in and put on the mask as I could in the early days. I just could not do it. And I decided to write my story or to write how I was feeling down. So my whole life became, visiting James, dealing with that and doing my book. And one day the care home manager, who saw the state of me leaving most days when I would go in, decided to have a lunch for the spouses. There were only three of us. Most of the patients were parents of children, of adult children, and we were the spouses. So we were the only three that had two husbands and one wife. She organized the lunch and I thought, oh, do I need this? And she said, it'll help because you've got to move on. It's now 7, 8 years. James has now been in dementia for 8 years. He's never going to come out of dementia. In fact, his time is running shorter and shorter. You've got to make a life. You've got to go out there, see people, meet people, do things. You can't just, vegetate and live through James. And she spoke to all the people around the table and they all agreed that, the adults, children were saying, yes, we get on with life. We come in here, we see mom, dad, and then we go home and we have a life. But for me, I could not do that. And then John spoke up. John was opposite me and I hadn't really paid much attention. He'd come in and he sat down and he was quite quiet, really. I thought him a little bit pompous, but he was kind of sure of himself. And maybe that's a male way of dealing with things. He was very articulate. I was like a jumbling, stammering wreck at this stage. And he had articulated very well how his life had ended, really, with Bonnie going into care and how much he'd loved her and how he'd met her and how beautiful and wonderful their relationship was. They'd been together for 30 years. I'd been with James for 21 years. And suddenly I could hear little similarities. And at the end of the lunch, he said, look, can I have your email? And I'll email you when I come into the home, because I do often come in and take Bonnie into James and we sit on his bed and look at the photographs on the wall and I take him downstairs, for a coffee. So it stunned me that he would do, and in all the time I've been coming into the care home, I'd never met him. And for a whole year, we emailed each other and it would be just, I've been to the care home today, I saw it, it was just very boring, or I'd been to an opera, or I had traveled back to the States and I'd sold our place in America. And I suppose the emails then became, there was a connection. He told me he loved Beethoven. He told me he loved going to opera. And I started to realize that there were a lot of similarities. He was on television, okay, in front of the camera, James was behind the camera. But there was a lot of things that I knew and had lived with. So the connection became kind of closer by email. And then we arranged to meet and we went and we had dinner, and it was a bit of a disaster, really. I think John probably thought, look, it's only a dinner, you know, don't make a big deal about it. But I felt very emotionally that I shouldn't be doing this. It was, you know, what am I doing here? And then we decided then, it was now 9 years, coming up to 10 years. He said, why don't we have a holiday? Let's just go away completely. Nobody will know us or know me anyway. And we'll have a holiday and then we can just talk about them. And so we had this holiday in Greece, which turned out to be an even bigger disaster. Because for the first time, I had been away with another man that I only knew from emails and a dinner and maybe two concerts. And I thought, what am I doing? You know, James is alive, and all the guilt piled onto me, all the Irish introspection piled onto me. John didn't see it like that. He just saw it as a holiday. He had his music. He was offered the flagship show on the Classic FM. So his life was booming. Mine was disintegrating. I didn't have anything happening, you know, apart from my book. And he would sit out on the terrace in August heat and play his music, totally happy with the world, as far as he was concerned, at that moment. I was dwelling on the past, dwelling on James, dwelling on how we met, and I could not let go. And after about 5 or 6 days, I said, look, I can't stay on this island. I really have to get back home. I can't. And in August in Greece, you cannot get a flight off any island. So we had to take a boat that took us 9 hours to get to Athens. And we arrived in Athens. And again, I tried to get a flight from Athens and I couldn't get a flight anywhere into Dublin from Athens. So I decided, right, we'd stay. Or John decided, look, let's just make the most of it. We'll stay here for the end of the holiday. We've only got 6 days left or 5 days left. So we would lie outside by the pool. He would read, I would read, and we didn't really talk for a couple of days. It was really strange. Then one day I decided I will never probably come to Athens again. I've never been before. And I suggested to John, shall we just go look at the Acropolis, go up and see Delphi? And we decided to have lunch and peace was made. So we left the hotel, we went out, we went to the Acropolis, we went up to Delphi, and we went out for dinner. And the next day, he flew back to London and I flew to Dublin. And I really didn't care if I ever saw him again. I don't mean it in that awfully harsh way, but it hadn't worked out, even though we weren't in a relationship. And the thing is, you know, like if he'd been a girl, I would have been exactly the same. I don't think I'd have managed a holiday with anyone. I wasn't in that place. So we returned to our respective places and John continued to email me. He said, you know, I really enjoyed the holiday. I know, you know, it wasn't your thing. But, you know, I'd like to take you to, there's a nice concert coming up. Would you join me? And we continued on. And by then I kind of got to know him as a person, and he really was a nice man, and I liked the fact that he kind of didn't push me into anything. Or so it was, and we did have lots in common. You know, we loved talking about music, I loved talking about art. I belonged to the Royal Academy, and I took him to an exhibition there. So, you know, we were having a really nice kind of, it was a friendship. And then I had the stress of James deteriorating. At this point, he was really getting very thin and really poorly. And I begged the doctor, who only came into the care home once a week and would only stay for 10 minutes at the most for each patient. And I began to see the ugly side of dementia, you know, the dismissal of them as people and as patients, and how there was no palliative care. There was no palliative care. And I knew James was dying. You know, I knew this man for 21 years and loved him above and beyond. And I knew that he was losing weight, he wasn't eating, he was just skin and bone. And he had to have teeth removed because you couldn't clean his teeth because you can't clean the dementia patient's teeth. And none of this was addressed. It was a whole saga. He had infections, he got bird sores on his knees and on his hips, and it was just a mess. And one day I actually went into his room and I played Mozart, Dillis. We had no connection, you see, for months and, well, years and months. And suddenly I played this He said, "Those are the marriage of the girl which he loved." And he started to mumble and smile and love, and I sang it badly with him. And it was a connection, and I completely broke down because it was my last connection with him. And it was like he said to me, "Look, I'm here. I love you," and all this. It was just, you know, he really did speak to me, and it was incredible, you know, liberation to me as well. It was as if saying, "Look, I know you've loved me all your life, but you must let me go." It was that sort of, you know, if you know the marriage of Figaro, it was the Countess singing of her love for him, and you know, it was really very romantic. I about 2 or 3 weeks later, I came back into the care room, and James was sitting in a wheelchair in front of a television screen, shaking like this and so thin, looking down at the floor. And I couldn't believe it. And I went into the office and I said, "I demand to see the doctor. I really demand he comes right now. I don't care if I have to pay whatever. I want to see him." And eventually the doctor arrived about 2 hours later. And I said, "Look at James, look at the state of him." And he said, "Oh, well, he does seem to have deteriorated in the last." I said, "No, this has been going on for nearly 18 months. James developed a C. diff infection. And it was a flow of diarrhea that gave him the most awful soreness on his bottom. He wasn't eating, and he really was like a skeleton. And eventually, he gave him what he needed to ease the anxiety. You could see he was dying, and he obviously gave him something stronger than he'd given him before. And within a week, James was gone. But to go through all that was just harrowing, and it haunts me to this day, actually, you know, that I didn't put up a stronger fight, that I didn't know the rules. And we had a very quiet funeral. I asked them all to come. I just wanted just to bear a few friends and his lovely carers who were there, and that was it. And it was very moving. And strangely, when I came out from the service, the sun was shining. And it was like, yes, it's over. James is not going to suffer anymore. I will never have to walk into that care home and just see him in that awful state I had to see him in. And now he's hopefully more of his peace, and that was a comfort. And after that, I returned home, and you can't forget something as traumatic as that ending or that journey with dementia. And John and I kind of got together, and his wife died 4 months later, so that was extraordinary. And I went up to see her before she died, and I went to the funeral, and we just decided to pick up the pieces and live, if you like. Now, there was no mention of us living together. I had my little flat outside London. A care home, obviously, fees took a huge toll on my savings, but it was what I needed. It was, you know, I got my stuff out of storage, and I built my little world around this flat, and I started to live again, if you like, as a single person without having to go to a care home every single day and whatever. And John would ring me, and he would say, "I saw an article in the Times today, or the Telegraph, or the Mail, or something. We might want to see it." And so we communicated like that for several months. And then we decided that, or he decided, he did all the deciding at that point. I think I would have been happy to lock myself away as I had done as a teenager into a convent. But so, you know, he decided that maybe we should have a holiday. How about India? And so we ended up going to India for a week. And the little hut we were staying in was called Moksha, which meant freedom. And I thought, I'm free, but I'm not free. I'm still holding on to James. But it was a lovely week. It was very Indian, very therapeutic. And it was healing. And I realized that John had many similarities to James, and maybe this was James and Bonnie's way of saying, you know, we're gone, but we're handing you each other, and, you know, and they'll never leave us. There are 4 of us in this relationship, which is kind of strange, because we shared this journey, and we eventually got married, and We're married, what, nearly 9 years, and it seems it seemed like a comfortable place to be. We know each other's history. John continues to write his books on Beethoven. I travel with him to do the research, as I did with James when he was doing on the Mozart. So many similarities. When we have a glass of champagne occasionally, we say to James and Bonnie. So, you know, they're in our hearts still. Even after all this time, we still hold them dear. And I don't think a day goes by that John will not say, oh, you know, Bonnie and I did that. Or I'll say, you know, James and I went to. So they're here with us. So it is a strange relationship in that sense, and a happy relationship. It feels like, you know, we've been kind of, you know, given a check and a lovely chance to have a life, and we're having that life.
To me, it feels like you kind of completed a circle.
Yes, it's exactly like that. We have completed the circle, and I think they would love it. And they would have loved each other. I think James would have loved John. They would have argued into the night that Mozart was better than Beethoven, or Beethoven was better than Mozart. And I think that Bonnie and I would have had an awful lot in common as well. So it's a huge comfort. And well, I wouldn't say we don't feel the guilt anymore. We feel guilt that they're gone and that their life wasn't complete. In a way, we've taken the batons, if you like, and we're running the life for them. And they're here with us all the time.
It's lovely that there was a happy end to your story, because you went through an awful lot. Both of you went through an awful lot, didn't you, together? And I think this has led you to wanting to raise the awareness about dementia, hasn't it? And you do a lot of work now about it.
Completely. I you know, finished the book, because my book was The Journey, How I Met James, Losing Him to Dementia, and the fact there was nothing out there to help anyone, and meeting John and the ending. And I decided when they were both gone and John and I sort of got together, we've got to continue this part. So we're campaigning all the time to get more awareness, more information, and raising funds for the charities. And we are going to continue doing this until we can organise a big concert to raise a lot of money. And that's my end game.
It's lovely to have a guest like you, because when I first started the podcast, I really wanted to talk about rebuilding lives after a big loss. And you and John have been through so much, and yet you have built a life together so successfully afterwards, haven't you? So it's a great example to have, and a lovely story to have. And I'm going end it here by saying thank you so much for joining me and repeating the title of your book, which is The Longest Farewell, James, Dementia and Me. Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you so much, Dylan. Thank you so much. And lovely meeting you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.